Hello, I'm Dr. Albert Rizzo, Chief Medical Officer of the American Lung Association. Welcome to Lungcast. And welcome to 2021. After year-long events challenged the very ways which we practice medicine and care for our patients, we've reached a mark in the calendar which often warrants resolutions: to improve, to begin anew, to find our stride. In the case of COVID-19 response, the year begins with new hope. Newly authorized vaccines have already been distributed and administered to millions in their first few weeks. Hopefully, this affords frontline workers and society a true aid in reducing the burden of the virus. In other matters of pulmonary medicine, refinement and reassessment are always worthwhile. This year began with some new perspectives on the side of asthma management. Last month, the National Asthma Education and Prevention Program released new asthma management guidelines. There were six major categories of asthma management that were addressed that had been determined by the work of an expert panel, which began with a 2014 needs assessment and continued with systematic reviews of the latest scientific literature. The final product culminated in 19 recommendations to enhance guidance on asthma management. The new guidelines represent cumulative changes in the ways of management asthma going forward, indicative of practice-changing progress during the last decade. So we open this year with a discussion of the new guidelines. Joining us today is guideline co-author Dr. Ann Dixon. Dr. Dixon is a pulmonologist at the University of Vermont Medical Center and a professor at the Larner College of Medicine, Burlington, Vermont. She serves as the medical director of the pulmonary disease and critical care departments. Dr. Dixon's research interest has focused on understanding the effects of obesity and metabolism on lung disease. She has developed a research program at the University Medical Center focused on this area. Evidence of her expertise in this field is reflected by her being the lead editor of the first book published on obesity and lung disease back in 2013, and the lead author of an American Thoracic Society statement on obesity and asthma. She has organized international meetings, bringing together experts in the field of lung disease with experts in the field of obesity and metabolism, with her overall goal for these meetings being to advance the field and foster the career development of new researchers in the emerging field of obesity and lung disease. Despite this busy research, clinical, and academic role, she volunteers for the American Lung Association and is currently on the National Board of Directors of the American Lung Association and is chairperson of the Scientific Advisory Committee and is also an active principal investigator in the American Lung Association's Airways Clinical Research Centers. I'm going to talk with Dr. Dixon about her research and the link of obesity and asthma, and also have her update us on the newly released 2020 focused updates to the asthma management guidelines from the National Asthma Education and Prevention Program, and share her provider-level contextualization and insight into the role of these recommendations at the clinician-patient level. I hope you enjoy. Thank you for sitting down today with me, Dr. Dixon. You are a member of the expert panel working group that recently released the 2020 focused updates to the asthma management guidelines from the National Asthma Education and Prevention Program Coordinating Committee. But before we get into that topic, I believe our listeners would like to hear a bit more about your research and thoughts surrounding the interplay between asthma and obesity. We know that not all obese asthma patients are created equal. It differs between children and adults, and it may also differ by sex. There is some evidence that obesity can raise the risk of asthma, that in some children, asthma might also increase the risk of obesity. Yet another possibility is that both diseases are a consequence of initial process, such as early life alterations in the microbiome or its interaction with the host immune system. Can you draw on your research interest and tell us how you got involved with this and your understanding of how this relationship has developed over the years?
Sure, Dr. Rizzo. I'd be happy to explain that. It actually first started back in the early 2000s with a study done by the American Lung Association Airways Clinical Research Centers. We were involved in a study looking at whether low-dose theophylline would help people with asthma. And surprisingly, we found that people whose BMI was 30 or above, so had a who were lean. So paradoxically, people with obesity seemed to have increased exacerbations when treated with theophylline, and this was quite unexpected. And the other thing when we looked at that study was there was a very high proportion of our patient population in that study that had obesity, which was very surprising to us at that time. Now, around the same time, there were a couple of other people that had publications suggesting that people with obesity had altered responses to medications. And so that was what really got me interested in it. It was an early finding from one of the ALA-ACRC studies. And I've since gone on to be very interested in this area. And really over the last decade, I think our understanding has transformed. I think early on, we used to think that obesity caused a little bit of restriction. You know, it made your lungs smaller, makes it a little more difficult to exercise. You get more short of breath. And I think most physicians thought that was the problem. But we've come to understand that obesity itself is a complex disease that affects the immune system. It affects how we respond, you know, to viruses, how we respond to air pollutants. And it actually fundamentally resets pulmonary physiology. And so I think our understanding of obese asthma has really transformed. And we understand now that it fundamentally changes what we've always recognized as early onset, you know, allergic asthma. And it also causes a unique form of airway disease, which we see particularly in women who develop this as adults.
So I think you're describing what seems to be different phenotypes of asthma and obesity, very much like we talk about phenotypes of asthma, phenotypes of COPD. But it sounds like there needs to be ongoing studies to understand this mechanism a bit more. And I know your group has some ongoing clinical trials. Do you want to talk a little bit more about those?
Absolutely. Well, we've got some studies actually going on working through the American Lung Association Network, the ALA-ACRC. One of the studies that we've got going on right now is been a pilot study to try and help us put into effect a lifestyle intervention, so a diet and exercise program. We just completed that study and we're looking at that data, and hopefully if that worked out, we'll be able to do a larger study. We've got another study going on with the ALA-ACRC using reflumilas, which is a drug that we use in the treatment of COPD, but a side effect of this drug actually is it causes weight loss and actually improves diabetic control, believe it or not. And we think metabolic inflammation, such as is related to diabetes, might worsen asthma and obesity. And so we're using this drug, reflumilas, for both its effect on the airway, for its effect on metabolism, and its effect on weight loss. So that's a study that we're doing right now. We just finished a study looking across the ACRC network at obese people with asthma, trying to understand their disease and what sort of comorbidities that they are suffering with. And we've recruited 100 people across the country, and we found out particularly that this is a disease that appears to cause marked decrements in people's physical functioning. Quality of life related to physical functioning is actually very, very low, and it's particularly afflicting minority populations and lower socioeconomic status people. So we think this really is contributing to worsening health disparities in people with asthma, and so this is something that we want to follow up on as well.
So before we go on to the asthma guidelines, I want to step back a bit. In my introduction of you, I mentioned you've been a very avid volunteer for the American Lung Association. You hold some leadership roles, and you've mentioned the ACRC a couple times during our interview already, and I wanted to just, for the sake of the listeners, explain a little bit more about the Airways Clinical Research Centers that you mentioned, and which is now in its 20th year, and you've been a member of it for I don't know how long of that period of time. Just explain what it does and how it works.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, this is a research network that I think first started in 1999, that the American Lung Association had the foresight to sponsor a research network, initially to study asthma. And the idea was to do studies in diverse patient populations of people with asthma and do studies that could really alter the way that we treat asthma, really designed to change the guidelines. And we did first study we ever did was on the influenza vaccine, actually, which seems very topical right now. There was a lot of concern that the flu vaccine might cause asthma exacerbations. And we found that that was not the case at all. That was a study published in the New England Journal way back in 2001. Over the last 20 years, the network has expanded. We now study COPD as well as asthma. We've done a lot of different studies, and one of the things that we're very excited about is we're soon going to be starting a study called the Lung Health Cohort, recruiting people across the country, young adults, to try and better understand what contributes to ideal lung health and what are the early markers of impaired lung health.
Very good. Well, thank you for your work in that, and thank you for being such a supporter of the American Lung Association. So as I mentioned earlier, you are a member of the NHLBI Advisory Council Asthma Expert Working Group. And based on input from previous guideline developers and the NAEPP participant organizations and the public, there has been a recent update. It had been actually 13 years since the last revision of the asthma recommendations, and we know substantial progress has been made since that time in our understanding of the origins of asthma as well as its pathophysiology and treatment. In my review of your update, it looks like there's six topics that were found to be have at least sufficient enough information to warrant an update in this focus guideline. So before we talk about those six topics, can you tell us how long you've been with the expert panel working group and how the review process got to this point in time to get this focused update out and running?
Sure, I'd be happy to do that. It's a very sort of rigorous, painstaking process. I was actually part of the expert panel that put the guidelines together. We were convened in 2018, but the decision to update the guidelines and the six topics, that whole process started back in 2014, actually. The parent committee reviewed a number of topics. Limited those down to six topics that they felt were of sufficient clinical importance and there was sufficient data to update the guidelines. And then there was a slightly different process that has been done previously. We used a GRADE methodology. So GRADE stands for the Grading of Recommendations, Assessment, Development, and Evaluation. And this is a very rigorous, transparent methodology and really is considered the gold standard for producing guidelines. And so the way this methodology works is we decided, or others decided, on the six topics, and that was after extensive discussion and input from the public. And then among the six topics, they came up with key questions pertaining to these topics. These key questions were then put out for a systematic review. The NHLBI commissioned part of AHRQ to do systematic reviews to answer all of these key questions. This was completed in about 2018, and that's when our panel was convened. And then our panel took the systematic reviews and had to decide what we felt were critical outcomes that should inform use of different medications. And we were, I think, use fairly standardized methodology. We were interested in exacerbations, asthma control, quality of life, using standardized questionnaire. And so we used those systematic reviews to find out how much benefit, what was the effect of any of these interventions. And then finally, once we realized what were the benefits, we also had to weigh what were the potential harms. What was the certainty of the evidence? What was the feasibility of implementing these particular interventions? Was it acceptable? And try and take into account patient preference as well. So it was a fairly painstaking process to go through. And once the committee had agreed, there was then a period of public comment, after which we went back and we did some more work to take into account that process. So it was painstaking, but very transparent process.
Great. Sounds like it. So I wanted to go over each of those six areas of update. The first one has to do with the intermittent use of inhaled corticosteroids and also the single maintenance and reliever therapy, often referred to as SMART.
Yeah.
How do you think this affects the treating physician on a daily basis with regard to their asthmatic patients?
Well, I think it changes it a lot. And one thing that I just want to make clear to everybody is that one thing we did not address was use of ICS formoterol in just mild intermittent asthma. So we did not address that. I know Gina has recommended ICS formoterol as needed, just for patients with mild intermittent asthma. That was not one of our key questions. So our guidelines still suggest albuterol for people who have symptoms less than twice. Where our guidelines really have changed is with persistent asthma. And so for mild persistent asthma, we actually recommend, well, if a patient is doing well on daily low-dose ICS and as needed short-acting beta agonist, it's fine to continue that. But as an alternative, we suggest considering as needed ICS, actually with a short-acting beta agonist albuterol. And what's been used in the studies is 2 to 4 puffs of albuterol immediately followed by 80 to 250 micrograms of beclomethasone or equivalent every 4 hours. So it's this combination of as needed ICS and beta agonist. And actually, we did not address as needed ICS formoterol for mild persistent asthma. That was not one of the key questions. But I think there is good data to suggest as needed ICS and beta agonists are probably pretty helpful for mild persistent asthma. And I've really already changed my practice as far as that's concerned. I think most important recommendations really for a change are with this moderate persistent asthma, the SMART therapy. So single maintenance and reliever therapy. And it's important to know that this is an ICS combined with formoterol. So formoterol has some unique properties. It has a very fast onset of action and it's a long-acting beta agonist. So it has, it works as a reliever therapy, but it can also work as a controller therapy. And so what we're recommending for moderate persistent asthma is actually regular use of ICS formoterol and then as needed. So use it as rescue therapy, just have one inhaler. And you can use up to 12 inhalations a day. And I think that there's a lot of very good data to support this. We reviewed data involving over 20,000 children and adults, and it does decrease the risk of exacerbations. So this was a strong recommendation with good certainty of evidence. So we think that is going to be a game changer.
You think, I know the committee as a whole did not really address adherence or compliance, but do you think this change or recommendation might help compliance in some situations?
I can tell you, you know, from my own personal experience as a physician working with patients, if we are only using one inhaler and if we're making it simpler, I think many of our patients will appreciate this. I can tell you in clinic yesterday, one of my patients said, I can get rid of one inhaler. So my anecdotal evidence yesterday is it should be helpful.
Yeah, I would support that as well. Thank you. So a mainstay of asthma therapy and symptom control has been the use of bronchodilators, long-acting beta agonists or LABAs, used in conjunction with the ICSs that you've mentioned. Your panel has also updated guidance around the use of long-acting antimuscarinic bronchodilators or LAMAs in asthma therapy. And what brought this about and how does this change guidance in the day-to-day treatment of asthma as well?
Yeah, sure. Well, it was new, this iteration, as LAMAs have only recently been available and approved for the treatment of asthma since the last update. So that was why it was addressed. And our recommendation is that first treat with, if you need to go out from an inhaled corticosteroid, first add on a long-acting beta agonist. And the reason for that is we compared studies that added either a long-acting beta agonist or long-acting muscarinic antagonist. And although they seem to have similar benefits, There was a slight concern about increased risk of harms, adding a llama compared to a lava. And so we recommend go with ICS lava first. And I think this fits pretty well into the SMART therapy. So get your patient on an ICS formoterol first before you think about adding a long-acting muscarinic antagonist. The caveat to that is if you've got a patient who for some reason can't use a lava, adding a llama to ICS is a reasonable alternative therapy.
Thank you. So we also know that allergies can play a significant role in disrupting good asthma control. And one of the update topics gives guidance about mitigating exposures to indoor allergens in particular. Again, please tell us why this was felt to be worthy of updating at this time and its impact for the patient and the clinician.
Sure. Well, I think one of the reasons was there was a lot of new data addressing allergen mitigation and also the clinical importance of the topic. It's something I think both patients and clinicians are very invested in. And so we addressed indoor allergen mitigation. And the first thing to be aware of is this is only for people who have allergy to an indoor allergen and are exposed to the indoor allergen. So it's not necessarily for everybody. And what we would recommend is a multi-component intervention. So I think it's a mistake to just have one strategy and think that's gonna prevent sort of the allergen-driven asthma. So impermeable pillow mattresses and mattress covers, for example, we recommend that as part of a more comprehensive indoor allergen mitigation strategy. The only thing that we recommend is sort of a single component would be pest management, you know, cockroaches and mice. And really the panel felt that that should be recommended as a public health intervention anyway.
So continuing on the theme of allergic asthma, I was particularly interested to see the update on immunotherapy for asthma maintenance therapy and the different levels of evidence between the subcutaneous and sublingual administration yeah. of immunotherapy. Please explain the importance of this update.
Yes. Well, obviously, allergen immunotherapy is something that a lot of patients are very interested in. And it's recommended for those with mild to moderate persistent asthma. It's not recommended for severe or uncontrolled asthma, as this could increase the risk associated with immunotherapy. And we are recommended subcutaneous immunotherapy based on good data that could decrease the risk, the risk of exacerbations, improve control and quality of life. But we did not find the data for the sublingual formulations. And actually, there are no sublingual formulations approved for the treatment of asthma, but by the FDA, though some have looked at the treatment of asthma. But we found that the benefits on critical outcomes, which again were exacerbations, asthma control, and quality of life, were actually trivial. Our caveat is, though, if you've got a patient with allergic rhinoconjunctivitis and also have asthma, you know, the sublingual immunotherapy will help their allergic rhinoconjunctivitis, and it may have some benefits for asthma, such as decreasing rescue medication use.
Another interesting update had to do with the role of exhaled nitric oxide, or FeNO. And this biomarker has been measured for a number of years in effort to identify and treat asthma. How does this update expand upon the role of measuring exhaled nitric oxide in the clinical setting?
Yeah, well, as you know, exhaled nitric oxide is used as a marker of eosinophilic airway inflammation. And the pros are as it requires minimal effort and has a few adverse effects. But it does require specialized equipment, and so not everybody might have accessibility to it, which was sort of one concern of the panel. But we felt that there was sufficient data to suggest that FeNO could be quite helpful as an adjunct to help make the diagnosis of asthma. So you don't make a diagnosis of asthma just based on the results of any one test. You need history, You need physical, you need spirometry, and exhaled nitric oxide can help you where there's doubt in terms of the diagnosis. There's also data to suggest when used in conjunction with other testing that it might be helpful to monitor, control, and adjust therapy. But again, it should just not be used in isolation. It needs to be used with other measurements and good history.
Right. And you did mention, and I know I've run into this problem in my own practice, the accessibility of getting a pheno measured because of the equipment and just the, sometimes the reimbursement issues play a role as well.
Yes. Yeah, that would. There was a lot of discussion about whether that, you know, might affect health equity as well, which was one of the things that we addressed in the GRADE guidelines.
Is it felt, however, that talking about it in the guideline might help move the needle on getting more access and more acceptance by third-party payers?
Well, and we helped to really delineate, you know, when should it be used, that it's not, you know, a standalone test, but it can be helpful. When taking everything into account. So hopefully that will help us all move forward.
Good. The other, I guess the sixth topic had to do with bronchial thermoplasty. And it's been thought as a possible treatment for severe and refractory asthma when the other modalities we've talked about have not been optimal. It's not readily available. And I know some third-party payers still consider it experimental and therefore lack coverage. I've had some patients of mine not able to have the procedure for that reason. So give us your impression of the update evidence in the role of bronchial thermoplasty with these patients.
Yeah, well, we actually recommended against bronchial thermoplasty unless it was in the context of a clinical study. And the reason we did this was we felt that there was insufficient data on long-term outcomes of patients on thermoplasty. And there was concern about the increased risk of short-term exacerbations. So we recommended thermoplasty only be performed in discussion with the patient about the potential risks and benefits. There may be patients who are willing to take on those short-term risks for potential long-term benefits. But we really do urge that be done in the context of some form of clinical study.
Right. So I think there were at least 11 other topics listed in the update that weren't addressed, but felt that there would be updates needed for those in the future. And they range anywhere from adherence issues to other biomarkers, biologics, and step-down therapy.
Yeah.
What do you think are the next steps with regard to what the future holds for the next update? What will happen between now and then?
Well, I think all of us on the panel felt that it would have been really helpful if biologics are going to be addressed in the future. And part of the problem here was the timeline. 2014 was the decision when the six topics were decided on, and that was before the omalizumab was the only approved biologic at that time, and I think we did not foresee the changes that were coming down the line with the biologics. So I do think we need to think about biologics in the future. And then in terms of other updates, you know, there is a lot of other things that can be considered, and I think. You know, we're going to have to start thinking sort of pretty soon about, you know, what are the future directions of the guidelines and what are the next questions to be addressed.
I wanted to go off script a little bit from the expert panel report just because of COVID and get your impression as a treating physician how COVID and the pandemic have affected your asthma patients, both from the standpoint of continuity of care and access to care. And do you see, I know there's been conflicting evidence as to whether asthmatics represent a risk, a higher risk of complications compared to others. Just wanted your thoughts on that.
Yeah, I've been following the literature with great interest, and you're right. There are some papers which suggest increased risk and some which suggest decreased risk. I tell you, though, I think many of my patients with severe asthma and myself as well are very concerned about how they would do with a severe viral infection. And so I'm being very careful right now. And so this is pretty difficult, but they're wearing their masks, following social isolation guidelines. And actually, I think with many of them, that they're avoiding the usual respiratory viruses they get at this time of year. So maybe are doing sort of a little better right now. But you know, with the cost of the social isolation and all the disruption that involves.
And I know we're right now in the midst of the rollout of the vaccines. And you mentioned earlier how the ACRC study done years ago showed that influenza vaccines did not seem to exacerbate asthma.
Right.
Are you going to have any hesitancy in recommending COVID vaccines for your patients with asthma at this point in time?
You know, I am telling all my patients that I think that the risks of getting COVID-19 far outweigh any right. risk associated with the vaccine. And that's how I feel about it personally myself. Much better off with the vaccine than with the disease.
Right. Yeah, I've been hearing that from a lot of experts like yourself saying the same thing. The benefit-risk ratio seems to really weigh in the right. benefit category at this point in time.
It's pretty scary when you see somebody with you know, severe COVID.
Just to kind of wrap things up, I know you're very heavily into obesity and asthma, and where do you see the other big, maybe research gaps that are still existing with regard to asthma and getting better understanding of disease and control?
Sure. Well, I'm sort of very focused sort of on the obesity, and it goes a little bit beyond obesity, wondering if simply, you know, dietary manipulations and improving dietary quality might help asthma, which is closely related to the work I'm already doing. I think understanding the role of the microbiome in asthma development, both in allergic asthma and non-allergic asthma, I think is going to be absolutely fascinating. I'm hoping we're going to learn a lot about that. And then really trying to better understand non-eosinophilic asthma. I think that's probably a lot of different diseases in there. And I'm hoping in the next 10 years we get a much better understanding of you know, what we're calling now type 2 low asthma.
Well, I want to thank you, Dr. Dixon, for taking the time today, sharing your expertise and insight into the treatment of asthma. I'm sure our listeners have appreciated it and hopefully will benefit from it. So we look forward to seeing your research in the literature in the future. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Dr. Rizzo. I so much enjoyed talking to you.
Thank you again to Dr. Dixon for joining us for today's episode. And thanks to her and her colleagues for their work in shaping these vital guidances for the field of asthma management at a time when cases are rising and pharmacologic and non-pharmacologic tools are evolving. It's crucial to be working with the most informed strategies possible. And thanks to you for listening. Whether you're joining us again from our launch in 2020 or just picking us up this year, we're very excited to kick off our 2021 edition of monthly expert discussions in the field of pulmonary medicine. Next month, we'll be turning to one of the most scrutinized and anticipated topics of the COVID-19 pandemic, vaccination development, distribution, and public buy-in to getting vaccinated, featuring an experienced and expert virologist and public health advocate. Be sure to subscribe to Lungcast on your favorite podcast channels and visit hcplive.com and lung.org for additional news and insights into respiratory medicine. Until next month, I'm Dr. Albert Rizzo, reminding you that if you can't breathe, nothing else matters, so just take it one breath at a time.